where he wishes to be," said Nuada softly. "There are no rigid patterns, no iron molds. We are not cast from bronze. The hero Petric once headed an army which looted 3 cities. I've read the histories. His men raped and slaughtered thousands, but at the end, he chose a different road. I cannot change. I am what I am. A runaway slave who murdered his master. I'm the ape. I'm Grounsel. And I've never had cause to regret what I have become."
"Then why are you troubled?"
Grounsel leaned forward, resting his arms on his knees. "Your tale was a lie, a flattery. Yet it touched me, because it ought to have been true. I've never cared about being loved. But tonight they cheered me, they lifted me high. And that, poet, was the finest moment of my life. It does not matter that I didn't deserve it, but I wish I had."
"Let me ask you something, my lord. When you stood before the beast and you saw its awesome power, were you not frightened?"
"I was," Grounsel admitted.
"And when it bore down on Arion, did it not occur to you that you could be killed as you charged to rescue her?"
"I did not think of rescue."
"But you saw that it was about to slay her."
"Yes, that is true."
"And you charged the beast and almost died. Every man there saw the deed.
You are too hard on yourself. It was heroic, and it touched all who saw it." "You confuse me," said Grounsel. "Tell me, does Arion love Chlor Givis?"
"I think that she does," answered Nuada.
The outlaw leader stood. "I was going to have him killed. I was going to take her, willing or unwilling. But now I owe him. For if he had not leapt upon the beast, I would now be dead and I would have missed the only moment of magic in my life. Gods, I am tired. And there's too much ale in this fat belly."
He walked to the doorway, but Nuada's voice halted him.
"My lord?"
"Yes," answered Grounsel without turning.
"You are a better man than you know, and I am glad I told the tale well."
Grounsel walked out into the snow, and Nuada settled back on his bed. For 5 days a blizzard raged over the forest. Teams of hunters roamed the western wood, seeking signs of the werebeasts. One gigantic wolf creature was found dead in a drift, and the howling was heard no more. The winter tore at the forest, and the mountains, temperatures dropping to 40 below zero. In the stockaded village, families stayed inside for much of the day, only emerging to gather wood for their fires. Of Grounsel himself little was seen. He took to walking the hills, avoiding his men. Nuada spent time with Arion and Chlor, and soon began to feel that boredom would kill him before the winter ended. There were few unattached women in the village, and those there were plied a trade he felt loath to patronize. As the days passed, the lure of Seltheron grew. He had the gold pieces Grounsel had given him, more than enough to pay for his passage, and imagined the marble palaces, the beautiful Nubar women, and, most of all, the warm golden sunshine. Soft beds, good food, cooked with spices or in wine, clean clothes and hot baths. He pictured himself swimming in a blue sea, the sun on his back. He talked to Grounsel's men. Apparently, the royal road to Pertia Port was less than half a day's walk away. Once on the road, it was 2 days to Pertia. Even so, Nuada did not relish the journey. But then Grounsel ceased his lonely walks and took to sitting in the hall, gloomy and sullen, his eyes on Arion. If Chlor noticed, he gave no sign of it. But the outlaw leader tried to goad him on several occasions. The former blacksmith would have none of it. But Nuada knew it was only a matter of time before the two men came to blows,
and he did not want to be in the village when the violence came. He liked Claw, and in a curious way Groundsel also. On the morning of the sixth day, Nuada slipped away from the village, continuing his way west through the frozen forest, seeking the sanctuary of the royal road with its inns and taverns. He walked for most of the day, and made his camp in a shallow cave out of the wind. There he lit a fire and berated himself for his stupidity. The village had at least been warm and welcoming. Out here death stalked him with icy fingers. The following morning, cold and frightened, he continued on his way, but the paths he had been told of were disguised by snowfall and the grey, lowering sky offered no clue to direction. He stumbled on, his feet numb, his body trembling, and by noon he was hopelessly lost. There was no cave to help him here, and he made a camp behind some boulders where he struggled to light a fire. But the wind blew it out. A great weariness settled on him, and the cold seemed to lessen. He was filled with the desire to lie down in the snow and sleep. "Don't be a fool," he told himself, and rising he forced himself to move on slowly. His foot sank into a snowdrift, and he almost fell. Reaching out, he took hold of a snow-covered branch jutting from the ground. The branch gave, the snow falling from it. Nuada screamed. What he was holding was no branch, but an arm frozen and black. He threw himself to his left and his body struck something solid beneath the snow. He scrambled to his feet as the snow fell away to show a man's upper body. The face grey, the teeth exposed in a sickening parody of a grin. Nuada looked around him. Everywhere there were signs of death. Panic swept through him as he backed away from the icy graveyard. "I won't die here. I won't." The smell of wood smoke came to him. Somewhere, someone had built a fire. The wind was in his face, so he headed into it, calling out. He staggered on, falling into a drift and pulling himself clear. The smell was stronger now. He called again, and fell. He began to crawl. "Over here!" He heard someone call and hands pulled at his arms. Nuada awoke in a deep cave where a huge fire was blazing. He sat up, pushing back the sheepskin-lined cloak that covered him. Seven men and four women were sitting round the fire, their faces thin and gaunt. "Thank you," he said. "You saved my life." The men ignored him, but a young woman with raven dark hair moved to sit beside him. "It is a temporary rescue, I'm afraid," she said. "There's no food and the roads are blocked." "Where are you from?" "We are from nowhere," she told him. "We are non-people now, trying to reach Cithaeron. We left the realm 4 days ago and joined with a caravan of refugees. Then the snows came." "Where are the others?" he asked. She waved her arm towards the cave entrance. "They are out there. Some have built wind walls. Others have tried to force a path through to the coast. They are dying." "How many are you?" 200 started out. I don't know how many have died." Nuada stood and fastened the cloak around his shoulders. He walked to the cave entrance and looked up at the sky. There were no clouds and the stars were shining like diamonds. "I will fetch help." "You almost died out there. Do not go back. Even if you conquer the winter, there is still the killer Groundsel." "Let me borrow the cloak," he said, "and I shall return with food. Gather as many of your people here as you can. Tell the others not to wander." "Why would you do this for nomads?" she asked him. "Because I am a fool," he told her. "Gather your people." He stepped out into the night and began to climb towards the east, following the pointing finger of the star warrior and lining his path with the great spear. On the point of exhaustion, he found a cave where he rested for 2 hours, warmed by a small fire. Then he pushed on.
By the middle of the following afternoon, he found himself on the hill overlooking the stockade. Weak from hunger and cold, he slipped and slithered down the hill. Chlor Givis saw him from the parapet and climbed down to meet him.
"Welcome back," said Chlor. "Was it an enjoyable stroll?"
"There are people dying back there, Chlor, starving to death. We must help them."
"First let us help you, poet. Your face is chalk white."
He led him to Arion's hut, where the girl was sitting by the brazier. She rose as he entered and laughed at him.
"Ah, the mighty hunter is home. Did you catch anything, apart from frostbite?"
Chlor helped Nuada from his frozen clothes and began to rub at the poet's skin, forcing circulation back to the surface. Arion warmed a towel by the fire, then held it to Nuada's face. He lay back as they tended him, and his eyes closed. When he awoke, Chlor was sitting by his bed.
"There are 200 people trapped in the forest," Nuada told him. "They are nomads. They have no food, and there is no way out to Sithaeron."
"A stupid time to try and escape," commented Chlor. "I would imagine it was that or die," said the poet. "We must help them."
"Why? I do not know any of them."
"Why? What do you mean, why? They are people, Chlor, like you and me."
"No, they are not. I am safe and warm in a hut, and I have food. I am not trapped."
"I shall go to Grounsel," snapped Nuada, swinging from the bed.
He stood and moved naked to the fire where his clothes were drying.
"A pretty sight," said Arion. "Such fine, pert buttocks."
He turned slowly to face her.
"Make your jests, Arion. Laugh while babies die of cold. Laugh while women sob at their loss."
Her smile faded.
"I do not laugh at them," she said.
"No, you do not even think of them. You disgust me, the pair of you. You're no better than the king. In fact, you are worse. He condemns them to death in order to steal their wealth, but you condemn them for no reason at all."
He dressed and tramped across the snow to the hall, where some 40 men were present, drinking, eating, telling stories. His arrival was greeted by a cheer, and he waved to the men and moved on to stand before Grounsel.
"I'm glad you are alive," said the outlaw. "I missed you."
He told Grounsel of the nomads dying in the forest, and the man shrugged.
"They chose a poor time to run. Still, the snow might clear in a few days. Some of them will get through."
"Will you not help them, my lord?"
"Is there a reason why I should? Can they pay me?"
"I do not know. But tell me, that magic moment we spoke of, how much was it worth?"
Grounsel's eyes narrowed.
"What has that to do with this?" he whispered. "I was drunk, soft in the head. I regret what I said."
"Then put a price on your drunken words. How much gold is such a memory worth? 10 rack? 20? 1,000?
"You know the answer," hissed Grounsel. "It is priceless."
"And that, my lord, is how those people can pay you. No monsters to slay, no acts of courage, just a gift to those who need it."
"And you, Nuada, what do you give?"
"I have nothing."
"You have the 20 gold rack I gave you, for your passage to Sithaeron. Will you pay that for grain?"
"Yes, of course, but..."
Nuada blinked as Grounsel held out his hand, then opened his leather hip pouch and counted out the coin. Grounsel put the gold to one side and leaned forward.
"And will you stay in the forest until I give you leave to go?"
"Stay?
He saw the look of dark triumph in Grounsel's eyes and swallowed hard. In Sithaeron, he could be rich again and live in a palace with beautiful women to wait on him. The sun was bright and warm, the climate temperate.
but here, amid the towering boredom?
Well, insisted Groundsel. I will stay, but I too have a condition, my lord. No more thefts from nomads. I'll stay for the hero, Groundsel, not the robber killer.
Groundsel chuckled and slapped Nuada's shoulder.
I agree to your condition. Groundsel, the lying oathbreaker, the thief and the killer, gives you his word for what it is worth.
Despite the heavy cloak and sheepskin gloves, two pairs of woolen leggings and fur-lined boots, Erin was bitterly cold. For 2 days he had followed Ubadai through the frozen forest, riding at a snail's pace for fear of injuries to their mounts. Some trails, simple in summer, had become death traps for riders, with ice-covered stones, holes part covered by snow, and trees heavy-laden and ready to fall at a breath of wind. Ubadai had said nothing for the whole of the first day, and when they had camped, he had built a good fire, rolled into his blankets and slept until the dawn. Erin knew the tribesman was angry, and the Gavilan lord felt a large measure of guilt over it. He had freed Ubadai, and the nomad had no reason to follow him back into danger. But then he had had no reason to ride into Maktha Fortress in order to rescue his former master either. It was baffling. On the third morning, as the sky cleared, Erin gazed up at the rising sun.
Which way are we heading today?
He asked Ubadai, as the tribesman rolled his blankets and strapped them to the saddle of his horse. Ubadai pointed to a trail through the trees.
But that's east, isn't it?
Asked Erin. Ubadai nodded, but said nothing.
Oh, come on, Ubadai, speak to me. Why are we heading east?
The tribesman grunted something inaudible, then turned to face Erin.
No tracks? Yes. Everywhere fresh snow. No chance to find woman. We go back.
We ought to search a little longer. We've only been here 2 days.
This is search. Two choices. The men either good or bad, yes? If good, they walk through near Royal Road to the south. If bad, they swing back. Wait till Cartain is gone. Deliver woman to Pertia Port when fleet comes in, yes? If they are good men, we have lost them. If bad, I think they come this way.
That's just a guess, said Erin.
Yes, but I am tracker, not wizard. They travel eastwards on first day. Not very good reason for that.
How do you know that?
The cave yesterday, where we rested. There were remains of two fires. And tracks to show three people. One with small feet but long stride. Only three people. Then why two fires? Woman sits apart.
Erin shrugged. It was little to go on, but Ubadai was the master in this venture.
You do not want to be here, do you?
He said as he climbed into the saddle. Ubadai mounted his horse and gave a sour grin, gesturing to the ice-covered trail.
You want to be here?
That's not what I meant. It is a duty for me, but why did you agree to come? Why did you come back for me in Maktha?
Plenty stupid, maybe, muttered Ubadai, edging his mount forward.
For 2 hours they rode until they slithered down a steep slope, towards a small grove of pine trees. Ubadai drew his mount to a halt and slipped his bow from under his saddlebags. He strung it, then blew on his fingers to warm them.
What is it?
Asked Erin, coming alongside.
Smell the air,
ordered Ubadai, and Erin lifted his head but could detect little, save perhaps a hint of wood smoke and a subtle, faintly unpleasant odor, reminiscent of the farmyard.
What do you make of it? Asked Erin.
Death, whispered Ubadai. And something else. Animal. Wolf, maybe.
Why are we whispering? We are downwind. It will not know we are here. Better ride back, maybe. If it is a wolf pack, we will scare them away. It might be Shearer, in trouble, he added swiftly.
I do not like the feel of this, said Ubadai. My skin crawls. I have good skin, and it knows where it wants to be, and it doesn't want to go in there.
Erin grinned.
You've hunted wolves before, and bears even a lion, if I recall. We're both fine archers.
An eerie howling came from the grove. The sound magnified beyond any wolf call Erin had ever heard.
On the other hand, he said, you might be right. I think this is a case for discretion.
But just as he was about to wheel his horse back to the slope, another sound broke the silence. A woman's scream. Erin cursed and spurred his horse into the trees.
You have no bow!
Shouted Ubadai, galloping after him. Erin's mount thundered into the clearing, saw the giant wolf creature with its saber talons and huge slanting jaws, and desperately tried to swerve. But the ice under its hooves offered no purchase, and it slid to its haunches. Erin hurled himself from the saddle, as the stallion cannoned into the beast and both animals went down, the beast slashing its talons through the horse's neck. Blood fountained over the monster's grey-white fur. The dying horse lashed out with its hooves, hurling the beast to the snow. The stallion struggled to rise, but the beast was upon it once more, rending and slashing. Erin climbed to his feet and drew the curved short sword given to him by Cartain. It was razor-sharp and beautifully made, but it seemed like a child's toy now, as he stared at the enraged beast. Erin swung his head. Shearer stood nearby, white-faced, holding a smouldering branch. He ran to her. The beast looked up from the dead stallion and climbed slowly across its carcass, staggering and almost falling. Rising to its hind legs, it moved towards the man and woman. Erin stepped in front of Shearer, placed his hand over his buckle and whispered,
Olathair.
Instantly, the advance of the beast seemed to slow. Erin waited until the creature was almost upon him, then ducked under a slowly moving sweep of the taloned arm and rammed his sword into the beast's belly. Shearer appeared alongside him, thrusting the branch into the creature's mouth. In that instant, Erin could see the talons moving towards the girl, and he let go of his sword and dived at her, dragging her clear. Behind them, Ubadai leapt from the saddle, notched an arrow to his bow, drew and loosed his shaft, which sped through the air to punch into the beast's neck. The creature staggered and fell on all fours. Then it rolled to its side and died. Erin climbed to his feet, his eyes scanning the clearing for any further monsters. To his right, there was a human leg, and across the clearing lay the grisly remains of another victim. Satisfied there were no other beasts, he once more touched the buckle of his belt and turned to Shearer.
Are you all right?
Yes, I...
Recognition showed in her eyes as she stepped back from him.
Erin, what are you doing here?
I was looking for you. Cartain was worried. He said the men you were with were probably in the employ of Okessa.
I think they were. But of all the men to rescue me, why did it have to be you?
He shrugged. It is pleasant, lady, to have succeeded in something. Her face darkened.
Do not think it absolves you from blame over my sister's murder. It does not. Nothing ever will.
I loved Dianu, and I would have done anything to save her. But I did not ask her to stay for me, nor did I know she was in danger. I do not much care whether you believe that. It is immaterial to me.
He moved to the beast and dragged his sword clear, wiping it clean of blood on the creature's fur. Reversing the sword, he pushed it at Shearer.
You want to kill me, lady?
Do it,
Go on, take the sword and push it home.
She turned away.
I was angry when I told Cartain I wanted you dead. I do not desire that, but neither do I desire your company.
You have little choice in that, Shearer. I'm here to escort you to Pertia Port, and then to Cithaeron. Once there, you can do as you please.
I am not going to Cithaeron. I will find Ochessa and see him dead. And if there was any sense of honor in you, you would do the same.
You say you loved Dianu. What a way to prove it, running to Cithaeron.
Erin took a deep breath, pushing back his anger.
In Cithaeron, we can raise an army. Here we can do little save run around a winter forest hoping we do not get lost, which may be all right for spoilt little girls, but it doesn't suit me. Now gather your things.
As he turned away from her, she grabbed his arm to swing him round, and her fist cracked into his jaw. Ubadai winced as he watched the blow crash home. Most women did not know how to punch, but he had to admire the smooth swing and the explosive contact. Erin was unconscious before he hit the snow. Ubadai strolled across and knelt by the unconscious nobleman. Then he looked up at the astonished Shearer.
I like you, girl, said Ubadai. You plenty stupid.
Chapter 11.
Nuada was furious when Groundsel told him bluntly that he would not be allowed to accompany the rescue party. The outlaw leader had gathered 30 men together, and each was carrying food, bread, dried meat, and fruit.
You need me to show you the way, protested Nuada. You need me.
I can find the royal road, Nuada, without any help. But look at you. You're on the verge of collapse. You could not stand the journey.
I'll get him there and back, said Clor Givis.
The snow had begun to fall thickly once more, and Clor, like the rest of the men, was warmly clad in oiled sheepskin and high wool-lined walking boots. A hood covered his blonde hair, and a long scarf was wound around his neck. Groundsel walked over to Nuada and placed a hand upon his shoulder.
Every step that you slow us down could mean a death on the royal road. You understand that?
I won't slow you down, I promise you.
Chlor pulled Nuada aside and offered him a drink from his canteen. Nuada accepted it and choked.
Gods of chaos, he spluttered. What is it?
It is a raw spirit distilled from grain. A little goes a long way. You feel warmer?
I feel as if someone just lit a fire in my belly.
Good, now let's go.
Groundsel set off at a good pace, feeling his way through the snow with a staff, thrusting it deep into drifts to test the footing. The men behind moved without a sound. There was no conversation, and Nuada knew that most of them could not understand the nature of their mission.
Why did you want to come?
Asked Clor as they walked some way behind the rescue party.
I told them I would, but also they fear Groundsel.
They're right so to do. You are leading the wolf into the lamb pen. Do not be surprised if he behaves like a wolf.
I will not be surprised, Clor.
Now tell me why you came with us. Clor chuckled and helped Nuada to climb a sloping drift. The wind picked up, howling ice and snow into their faces, and further conversation became impossible. A journey which had taken Nuada a day and a half was made in less than 4 hours by the rescue party. They came across the first bodies lying huddled by a dead fire. There were 2 women, an old man and a child. All were frozen stiff. Groundsel hawked and spat. Ice had formed on his dark brows and short beard.
Stupid, he said. Had they built the fire 20 paces over there by those rocks, they would still be alive. How could they think a fire in the open would warm them?
Leaving the bodies where they lay, the men pushed on, coming to the cave at mid-afternoon. Some 40 people were crowded there. 4 were dead. Groundsel led the men inside and they broke out the rations. The 2 fires were dying down, and Khalor Givers returned to the forest for fuel. Nuada scanned the gaunt, weary faces, glimpsing the girl at the back of the cave. She was squatting beside an elderly woman, and he pushed his way through to her.
"I came back," he said simply. "She's dead," replied the girl. "She died an hour ago."
Nuada gazed down on the serene face. The woman was in her late 60s, he guessed, and she had the look of the patrician.
"Then nothing can harm her now," he said. "Come, there is food." "I'm not hungry."
He put his arm around her slender shoulders and pulled her to him.
"Would she want you to die also?" he asked. "Follow me."
Taking her by the arm, he led her to Groundsel, who gave her some bread and a canteen of water.
"The cave could not take all of us. There are others still outside," the girl told them.
Groundsel turned away and sent 3 groups to search the forest. Khlor Givers went with them. In the cave, a woman fell at Groundsel's feet, hugging his legs and crying quietly. Embarrassed, he pulled away. A man came to him, seizing his hand and pumping it. Others joined him. Groundsel accepted their gratitude with ill grace and pushed his way out into the blizzard. He walked alone for a while and watched the men searching the snow. There were bodies everywhere. He was about to return to the cave when he heard a whimper from close by and looked around, but there was no one to be seen and the sound ceased. Taking his staff, he probed the bushes, but could find nothing. He stopped and listened, but the howling wind obscured any lesser sounds. He crouched closer to the ground. Still nothing. To his left, there was a small drift of snow. As he looked, the wind caused it to flurry and he caught sight of an edge of cloth. Moving to it, he dug away at the snow. Buried here were a man and a woman huddled together, frozen in death. But they had curled themselves around a small child, wrapped in a woolen blanket. Groundsel could imagine their last thoughts. Protect the child until the end, their bodies shielding it from the wind and the snow. The child's head moved and its mouth opened. Groundsel swiftly lifted it clear of the snow and ran for the cave. Inside, he forced his way to the fire and pulled away the frozen blanket, rubbing at the little girl's slender limbs. Her hair was short, but tightly curled and golden, and she was thin, terribly thin.
"Akis," he called. "Where the hell are you?"
A stocky man came forward.
"Did you bring the milk?"
asked Groundsel.
"It's mostly gone, my lord,"
replied the man. Ever since Nuada's saga of the beast, men had begun to echo the poet's style of address.
"Get some here, now, and warm it." "Yes, my lord."
The girl's head sagged against Groundsel's shoulder.
"Don't you die on me," he shouted. "Don't you dare die on me."
He shook her and rubbed her back and she began to whimper.
"That's it," said Groundsel. "Cry. Cry and live."
"Shall I take her?" asked a woman.
"Leave me alone," snapped Groundsel,
as Akis returned with some milk, warmed in a wooden bowl. The outlaw leader lifted the girl's head and held the bowl to her lips. The milk dribbled to her chin as she shut her mouth against it.
"Pinch your nostrils," said Groundsel,
and a woman crouched down beside them and followed his bidding. The child's mouth opened. At first she choked on the milk, but then she began to swallow. When the milk was finished, her head sagged again to his shoulder. He was about to shake her when the woman touched his arm.
"She is asleep," she said. "Just asleep.
She will be fine. Wrap her in a warm blanket and leave her with me. I'll take care of her.
Groundsel was reluctant to part with the child, but he did so, brushing the hair back from her brow.
She is pretty, he said, and tough. I like that in a child. How old is she? I'm not good at judging ages in babes.
I would say around 2 years old. She might be a little more, but she's very thin and small.
You look after her, said Groundsel, rising.
Yes, my lord.
I'm not a lord. See to her.
He saw Hlorgivis helping a young couple into the cave, which was now becoming seriously overcrowded.
It's a nightmare out there, said Hlor. There are bodies everywhere. Must be close to 100. How many survivors?
Groundsel asked.
I've seen around 30. There's no room for them here, and if we don't find shelter of some kind, many more will die.
There are deeper caves about 3 miles from here, said Groundsel, but bears inhabit some of them. At least you can kill a bear, muttered Claw, but we can't beat this cold.
Other survivors began to crowd into the cave entrance, shouting for room to be made. Those at the center were being pushed too close to the fires, and arguments broke out. Groundsel stepped onto a boulder so that he could see over the heads of the milling refugees.
Silence! He bellowed. All movement ceased. We will need to march out into the blizzard. I want the strongest among you ready to move in the next hour. The rest can stay here. I will leave men and food, and we will come back for you when the blizzard dies down.
Some of the refugees began to shout, refusing to leave the sanctuary of the cave.
You will do as you are damn well told, Groundsel roared, or else I'll leave you all to starve. Now, there are deeper caves around an hour's march from here. There we can build fires to keep you alive. Anyone who believes they can make the journey, move to the left of the cave. Those who wish to remain, move to the right.
Slowly the refugees began to shuffle into place. Groundsel stepped down and an elderly man approached him.
I thank you, sir, for your help. Tell me, are you the hero Hlorgivis?
No, I'm the devil Groundsel.
The man's eyes widened and he backed away.
Those on the left, move out of the cave, now,
shouted Hlorgivis.
Come on, make room.
Groundsel found the woman nursing the child he had saved, and leaning down he took the sleeping girl.
You are going to take her out into the cold, said the woman. Is that wise?
I'll keep her safe, promised Groundsel,
opening his sheepskin jerkin and closing it around the child. Outside, the blizzard had eased, and the snow was falling less thickly as Groundsel took the lead and the thin column set off. Akis, Nuada, and 4 others remained in the cave, distributing food and building up the fires. There was more room now, and the group was mostly made up of the elderly or the young. Nuada was tired, more weary than at any other time in his young life, but he felt curiously lifted and filled with a sense of quiet joy. He sat back against the cave wall and looked at the people sleeping by the fires.
His people. His by blood and by deed.
The raven-haired girl sat beside him. Her mother's body lay at the back of the cave, a thin linen sheet over her face.
My name is Katia, said the girl.
She was still cold, and he lifted the blanket from his shoulder and drew her in. He said nothing and leaned his head back against the rock wall. It felt like a feather pillow. And he slept without dreams. The journey to the deep caves took more than 4 hours, but the snows held off and the temperature rose marginally. Even so, many of the weaker refugees needed assistance, and Hlorgivis and 2 others followed some way behind the column, watching out for those who fell by the wayside. Chlor gave some of them a mouthful of the fiery spirit, hauling them to their feet. Only one man died during the trip, his heart giving out as he struggled to climb the last hill. Once at the caves, huge fires were lit, and the refugees gathered gratefully around them. The child Groundsel was carrying awoke, and he fed her with the last of the milk. Chlor Givis watched him with the girl, his pale eyes betraying no emotion. Feeling himself observed, Groundsel passed the child to a middle-aged woman and walked back to the cave mouth, where he sat down opposite the tall warrior.
"I like children," Groundsel remarked, his dark eyes staring challengingly at Chlor.
"So do I. I think the blizzard has passed. The worst should be over for now."
Groundsel gazed at the sky.
"No clouds. It will get colder yet."
"What will you do with them all?" asked Chlor. "How will you feed them, take care of them? And how did Nuada talk you into it?"
Groundsel shrugged.
"I have a full granary, and they can work for their food. They can fell trees, gather wood. The younger women can haul for my men. We've not enough women as it is. 3 men were killed recently in a fight over a woman." Chlor nodded.
"And the last question, why?"
"I don't answer to you, Chlor Givis. I answer to no one. If I choose to do a thing, I do it. I may choose to kill them all tomorrow. My choice. Why did you come?"
Chlor shrugged.
"I needed the exercise. I felt like a dog in a cage. How's your back?" "I heal fast."
"You'd better watch for infection. I've seen animal scratches turn bad. Very bad."
"Not here," said Groundsel. "The air is good for wounds. Not one case of gangrene have I seen since I came to the forest."
He was silent for a moment, remembering the pain and the fear when the talons sliced home.
"That was a mighty beast, was it not?" "Damn near broke my axe," said Chlor.
"Has it occurred to you what fools we were to sit in the open?"
"Once or twice," Groundsel admitted. "So far my hunters have found 6 more of them, dead in the snow. But there is no clue as to their origins. No one has ever heard of anything like them before. I've even sent men to seek the Dagda and ask for his counsel."
"You know where he lives?"
"No, but the men will go to all the settlements, seeking news of him," said Groundsel. "He will hear of it, wherever he is."
"The important question," said Chlor, "has to be, who sent the creatures, and why?"
"Sent them," responded Groundsel. "They were not a hunting pack of hounds. I saw no leashes, and no man alive could train those creatures."
"Remember the boy? He said he watched it appear from the air in a flash of lightning. Our own hunters found tracks that just appeared on a hillside. No, someone wants to bring death into the forest. We need to know who."
"We do indeed," Groundsel agreed, "if you are correct. But I'm not convinced. There are parts of the forest that have never been explored. High valleys, lonely canyons. The beasts could have been driven down by lack of game, or even curiosity."
"Maybe," said Chlor.
"But you saw the wolf creature. It was not completely covered in hair. Its chest and belly were dark-skinned. Such a beast would be unlikely to live high where the air is cold. And the other creature that was found dead in the drift, the cold killed it. What forest beast have you heard of that does not prepare for winter?" "It's a compelling argument. But where does it take us? Some sorcerous animal trainer releases his pack in the mountains? How would we find him? Or recognize him if we did?"
"Find him?"
"We cannot," admitted Chlor. "But another wizard could." "I take it this is leading somewhere," Groundsel snapped, You don't exactly find yourself surrounded by wizards about here.
There is a lad at my village who claims he was an apprentice to a man of magic named Ruad Rofessa. When the snow clears, I will seek him out. Groundsall stood and stretched.
That means leaving the sanctuary of the forest. A risky venture, strong hand. With that red gold beard and that pale hair, you are an easy man to recognize. And how would we poor forest folk fare if our great hero was taken from us before he could raise his army?
I think you would manage, my Lord Groundsall, great slayer of beasts and rescuer of small babes.
Claw stood and gazed down at the smaller man. Groundsall smiled, but it did not reach his eyes.
I think I like you, Claw. I really do.
That's good and very reassuring.
Don't be too reassured. I've killed men I've liked before.
I'll remember that. For 5 days Ruad waited, opening the black gate each evening and holding it for an hour. Once, a giant lizard with serrated teeth tried to force its way through, and he sent it scurrying back with a burst of white fire. On the 6th day, he was too weak to attempt the power spell, and walked wearily back to the village. Gwydion said nothing as he entered the small cabin that had been cleared for them. The old man merely put his hand on his friend's shoulder. Ruad shook it loose.
I've lost him, he said, slumping to a chair.
Gwydion sat beside the armourer, staring into the broad, ugly face and seeing his own reflection in the bronze eye patch. Ruad cursed.
I sent him to his death, just like all the others. He was a man. He made his own decisions, said Gwydion. And gods, Ruad, it was worth the risk. If the knights of the Gabala could assemble once more, we could sweep the land clean of this evil. We could raise a rebel army.
They are all dead, Gwydion. Let me rest. Ruad stumbled to a straw-filled mattress set against the wall and stretched himself out. Gwydion moved to him.
I will give you sleep, he said, touching his finger to the wizard's brow.
Ruad's eye closed, his breathing deepening. Gwydion reached effortlessly into the colors, marveling at the strength of the green, feeling the power flowing from the millions of trees and the birds and animals drawn to them. He replenished his strength and opened his eyes. The candle was burning low and guttering, so he lit another from the stub of the first. A light tapping disturbed his thoughts, and he moved to the door and opened it. A youth stood there, pale hair glistening in the moonlight. Behind him stood a taller man, dark-haired and dark-eyed.
Yes?
Asked Gwydion.
Is someone sick?
No, sir, said the youth. I'm seeking Ruad Rofessa. I was his apprentice. My name is Lamfada.
Gwydion reached out and touched the youth on the shoulder. There was no evil in him.
Enter, said the old man, but talk softly, for Ruad is asleep and he needs his rest.
The newcomers entered the cabin and Gwydion stoked the fire, hanging a kettle over the coals.
Would you like some herb tea? It is sweet and aids gentle dreams.
You do not remember me, do you? Said the hard-faced man. He thrust out his right arm, exposing the leather-covered stump.
Eladan, I heard you were dead. I'm glad to see the story was untrue. You must forgive me. I'm growing old and forgetful. When last I saw you, it was as a knight arrayed in silver armor, a black-plumed helm on your head.
Long ago, Gwydion, another age. The world has changed since then, and not for the better.
Gwydion poured boiling water into a copper pot, and added dried leaves, stirring the mixture with a wooden spoon. He let it stand for several minutes, and then transferred it to 3 round-bottomed mugs.
Why are you here?
Asked the old man.
I have hopes that the wizard can mend my arm, said Eladan. Lamfada tells me he can do anything.
How did you find us?
Lamfada grinned.
I have been practicing with the colors. I cannot master the majors, but I can now fly the yellow, and I sense Ruad was in the forest, though I could not tell where except that it was to the east of where I was. Then we heard of a healer and a wizard, and men were speaking about the three golden hounds. I was there when Ruad was working on the last of them, so I knew it was him. Do you think he will be angry that I sought him out?
I do not believe so, said Gwydion. But he has suffered a terrible loss, and you may find him changed. Have patience, Lamfada. And you, Eladan, do not expect overmuch. Ruad is a wizard of great power, but some things are beyond mere men.
My hopes were never high, Gwydion, but we will see.
Gwydion turned his attention back to the youth.
The yellow, he said, is a wondrous color. I too learned my skills in such a way. It is the color of dreams.
And yet it has no power, said Lamfada.
No, no, you are wrong. The yellow leads us to all the other colors. It is a guide. Without it, there would be no wizards, no healers, no mystics, no seers. Tell me, as you ride the yellow, what color do you find pushing at the edge of your mind?
None, sir.
In time, you will find yourself drawn to another color, which will intrude as you fly the yellow. For me, it was green, and I became a healer. For others, like Ruad, it is black. For some, sadly, it is the red. But the yellow will lead you to the color of your life, for good or ill.
Are all men governed by colors, then, even when they are not sorcerers? Lamfada asked.
Of course. The colors are life. Look at Eladan. What color does his soul wear?
The warrior said nothing, but Lamfada swung to look at him.
I do not know, said the youth. How does one tell?
It takes little magic, my boy, said Gwydion. A farmer is a man who loves the land and the yield of the land. He is the green of growth. But a warrior? What other color is there for a man who lives to strike his fellows with a razored blade, or a deadly mace, or a flashing lance? Aladan's color is red, and he knows it. He has always known it. Am I right, King's Champion?
Aladan shrugged. There will always be a need for warriors. I feel no shame at what I was.
Ah, but then you were not a warrior. Because of that need? You chose the path because you enjoyed the fight.
That is true. Does it make me evil?
No. But neither does it bring you close to sainthood, said Gwydion, reddening.
He took a deep breath.
Forgive me, Eladan. I have no right to berate you. But much of my life has been spent healing wounds caused by swords or arrows or axes, dealing with the result of hatred, lust, or greed. I know you are not evil. But I loathe the men of swords. Come, it is late. Rest here, and we will speak to Ruad in the morning.
Erin regained consciousness after a few moments and sat up groggily. Ubadai helped him to his feet.
Bad chin, said the tribesman, grinning.
Erin staggered. I'm sorry, apologized Shearer. I thought you'd move or something. I mean the speed with which you tackled the beast. Are you all right?
Only my pride suffered lasting damage, said Erin. Can I sit down somewhere?
Not here,
replied Ubadai, gesturing at the bodies.
Blood will bring many creatures, wolves, lions, who knows. You can sit on my horse.
No, he can't,
said Shearer. "It ran as soon as you dismounted."
"Better and better,"
Ubadai grunted. The tribesman scanned the area, then pointed to a nearby hill.
"There should be caves. With our luck, many beasts there. Hip deep in beasts. Still."
He gathered the saddlebags and provisions from Erin's dead mount, and waited while Shearer fetched her meager pack from the shelter beneath the tree. Then he supported Erin as they moved slowly uphill. The fresh mountain air soon revived the nobleman. As Ubadai had predicted, there were many shallow caves. He entered one on the south of the hill, but backed out swiftly.
"There,"
he said. The second cave was empty, and the nomad gathered wood and built a fire. Shearer settled down beside the fire, grateful for the warmth, and sat watching Erin.
"I really am sorry," she said.
He shrugged.
"Don't be. I never was very good at defending myself. My old sword tutor said my wrists were as strong as damp lettuce."
"You moved well enough against the beast, and that sword thrust all but disemboweled it."
"Beast was dying anyway," Ubadai told Shearer. "You could have killed it with that branch."
"What is that supposed to mean?" Erin asked. Ubadai shrugged.
"Sick, maybe. But when it killed horse, it nearly fell. It did not charge, it staggered."
"That's a nice thought," snapped Erin. "The conquering knight kills a sick beast. Hardly the basis for a great saga. It didn't look ill to me."
"Yes, it did," said Shearer. "Its chest was almost blue, and it did fall before attacking."
"It had thin skin," said Ubadai. "Not good for cold."
"Can we stop feeling sorry for the creature?" asked Erin. "It wasn't exactly a wounded rabbit."
"You wait here," said the nomad. "I'll find horse."
After the tribesmen had gone, Shearer built up the fire. "It doesn't matter that the beast was not at full strength, Erin. You still tackled it, and you pulled me clear of the talons with astonishing speed." He grinned at her.
"I was rather pleased with that."
He wanted to tell her about the belt, but thought better of it. It was pleasant to be seen in an heroic role. Looking at Shearer, he was struck by her similarity to her sister. The same wide eyes and full lips, the same piercing gaze. Shearer was taller, her hair shorter and more tightly curled, but there was no doubting the bloodline.
"What is wrong?" she asked,
as she saw his face change.
"Nothing. Would you like something to eat?"
"Not at the moment. I'm still a little queasy from the battle."
"It was brave of you to stand before the beast, with just a burning branch," he said. "You looked very impressive there."
"I didn't have time or space to use my bow. You showed great skill in charging your horse at it."
"I can't claim too much credit for that. The poor animal was trying to stop and lost its footing."
He looked away and silence fell between them.
"Look,"
he said at last. "About Dianu."
"Let's not talk about it,"
she said, her face hardening.
"There are some things that must be said. I was a fool, I know that. And no amount of breast-beating will erase it. But I knew nothing of the danger she was in. I did not know you had nomad blood."
"You killed her, Erin.
Your arrow pierced her heart." He closed his eyes, then opened them to stare into the flames.
"Yes," he agreed. "My arrow. But you do not know what it was like. I had a broken leg and was making my escape. I wanted to rescue her, but I could not get down from my horse. When I rode to the hilltop, she was being tied to a stake at the top of a pyre and..."
"I don't want to hear this."
But Erin pushed on. "If I had reached her, I could not have freed her. She would either have burnt slowly to death or choked on the smoke. What would you have done, Shearer?"
all those people around her, she whispered. She must have known many.